I'm here on behalf of Edwin Scarborough this morning, who was convicted in the Superior Court, Kent County, of maintaining a motor vehicle for the purpose of drug possession, tampering with evidence, and resisting arrest. Those convictions were a result of a plea agreement by Mr. Scarborough with the state. One of the features of this plea agreement was that the defendant was warned of the sentencing range, and part of the range was that that he could be sentenced up to life imprisonment because he was potentially an habitual offender. However, later on, it became evident at the time of his sentencing that there was another aspect to this plea agreement, and it was perhaps the most critical aspect of the plea agreement, and that was that the state's recommendation of habitual offender sentencing, which would be mandatory if the state submitted an habitual offender motion supporting sentencing, factually speaking, on prior convictions, which wasn't contested. The state's recommendation, or the state's submission of it, and the defendant's habitual offender sentencing as opposed to ordinary sentencing, was dependent upon an off-the-record agreement between the parties. The parties had agreed between themselves that if Mr. Scarborough cooperated, says, with law enforcement authorities and drug investigations, that the state would not petition for habitual offender sentencing.
Now, is it fair to assume that the reason that that agreement was off the record, if there indeed was an agreement at all, was so there would be no public knowledge that he would be working for the police?
That's fair to assume, Your Honor.
Why was the option of putting it on the record quietly in camera not the case? Why didn't that happen?
Perhaps it was custom, Your Honor. Perhaps it was an oversight on the party's behalf. They didn't realize they couldn't do it. This is a feature.
Did no one read Cole? We made the point in Cole, I thought, that it's important to put these agreements on the record in some fashion.
Yes, sir.
So we don't get into this construct. Was there agreement? What were its terms? Who agreed to do what, when, where, under what circumstances, and what the consequences of not following through would be for either party?
Yes, sir.
What, we just, nobody pays any attention to it?
Well, I'm not sure it's not paying attention. Perhaps it was an oversight. For instance, in Cole, Cole, the parties, particularly the appellant in Cole, did not cite Rule 11 to the court.
Was Cole even out at the time this agreement?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor.
Or am I? That's why I asked.
Cole wasn't a plea, so Rule 11 wouldn't have applied. Cole was a person who was testifying, and he wanted to give, and they were going to check out his story, but Cole wasn't a plea case.
I believe Cole was a plea, Your Honor. I believe Mr. Cole entered a plea to the offenses for which he was convicted later on that afternoon after they reached an agreement about the investigators would not dine him out to his co-defendants and would give the benefit of not proceeding with capital sentencing.
Let's not worry about that now, but the only reason I stated what I stated was it's my hope in any event that when these agreements that are, quote, off the record, close quote, which have the potential to disrupt a plea negotiation or cause someone to go to trial under circumstances that do or do not involve seeking the death penalty, that there's some writings in some fashion, even if it's just a statement in a transcript on the record or letters between counsel or something that gives us the opportunity to know that, A, there was an agreement, what the terms of the agreement were, and some way to measure whether the agreement was breached or not. In the absence of a record, we just listen to counsel tell us what they think may have occurred, and often it's not counsel who was even a part of it. It's appellate counsel. But that's not very helpful for us.
No, it's not, Your Honor. The court certainly emphatically made that point, as in Cole. Perhaps it was lost on the parties here. Perhaps they were not aware of Cole. Perhaps they were not aware, says, of Rule 11. In addition, To be candid, it is a little bit of a burden and inconvenience on counsel under these circumstances. Granted, the state may have an interest, the defendant may have an interest in not disclosing a particular agreement publicly.
It's very disconcerting to read a record that says there are no other agreements. Everybody stands there and listens to the representation that there are no other agreements, and then the whole appeal turns on an undisclosed agreement.
Yes, sir, I agree.
Superior Court Judge used to ask the question of the defendant, is there any other agreement between you and the state? Are we saying that the defendant now is told by counsel to lie in response to that question?
I'm not sure I'd come to that point. I don't want to make this a blameworthy type situation, as on counsel. This may have developed through custom practice, as in the court, lack of familiarity, says, with the rules.
As I said, I can understand the reasons that neither the state nor the defendant would want the existence of the side agreement, for lack of a better term, to be known generally. That's perfectly understandable. But there needs to be some kind of recording of the existence of the agreement and some kind of notice to the trial judge.
Yes, yes, sir.
That there is an agreement, though the defendant's not prompted to lie under oath in response to a question from the court, and the court's not under the assumption that the answer that the judge is getting before he takes the plea is correct.
We agree with that, Your Honor. That objective could have been accomplished here, for instance, by the parties notifying the court and asking for a sidebar. If a sidebar would be burdensome or inconvenient to the court, a busy court with a schedule at that point.
But you can see the problem in this case, because part of the judge's ruling is, you told me there were no other agreements.
Yes, sir.
And if you said there were no other agreements, now that you come back to me and try to enforce an undisclosed agreement, you're bound by what you told me.
On its face, it looks that way. I asked him, says, were there any other agreements? But an agreement is not concrete unless it's in writing, says you can't pick it up.
Well,
an agreement
is in the even if the state says, yes, there indeed was another agreement, but our position is the defendant did follow through on it. Then we get into whether they did or they didn't. And
that comes with the territory, says, so to speak, but that isn't true in all cases. And the trial courts resolve those questions every day.
There's an ethical obligation lawyers have to be candid to the tribunal. And it seems inconsistent with that ethical obligation to have two lawyers listen to somebody say there's no agreement and have no one speak up.
I really, to be candid with Your Honor, I don't want to address that because one of my colleagues was representing, says, the defendant. And that's why I don't want to put it in a blameworthy type situation.
I don't think the gist of Justice Holland's question, the gist of my questions were not that counsel committed an ethical violation. What we're trying to get around is the practical problem. The practical problem is it's clear neither state nor the defendant wants the side agreement to be generally known, for obvious safety and the efficacy of the agreement itself. Reason, that's totally understandable. There has to be a way to get that result and get the plea on the record with full disclosure, at least to the trial judge. So there's a record of what's really going on somewhere. Mm-hmm. That way we can figure out later, if the plea itself is challenged, whether the end be and end of it all is, you told me there was no, you told me this was the entire agreement between you and the state. And at the time you told me that, neither you nor the state believed it was, and the representative of the state and your counsel sat there while you gave me that answer. What's a trial judge to do in that situation? What are we to do in that situation?
Well, the what to do under that situation is to permit the plea to be withdrawn, says under Rule 11. Although a little bit inconvenient, this problem could be addressed and could be addressed in all situations by a sidebar with a court reporter, and that's sealed, or if the court is...
But why is letting the plea be withdrawn the solution? The state says, indeed, there was an agreement. The real issue was the defendant didn't follow through with it, so he's not entitled to withdraw his plea when he didn't follow through with the side agreement.
Well,
so where does that all leave us?
The rule says that if a plea agreement has been reached by the parties, the court shall, on the record, require the disclosure of the agreement in open court or on a showing of good cause in camera at the time the plea is entered. There was a literal says violation of that mandatory says rule here. Now, under circumstances where there is a dispute concerning whether there was an outside agreement, and that can happen, it's conceivable that the court will say or find as fact that no, I'm not permitting a plea to be withdrawn under those circumstances because I don't believe there was an agreement with respect to what the defendant is contending at this point. This case is unusual in that respect because the state itself is conceding that there was an agreement.
But you see, and the rule is not. You're arguing that the plea should be withdrawn because of the lack of the disclosure. And yet, on the other hand, you just told us you don't want anyone to get in trouble. Maybe it was a custom. So if we assume that there really was more to the agreement than was put on the record, why, as the Chief Justice implies in his question, isn't the remedy now for a remand to see whether your client kept his end of the big agreement?
Well, we don't believe that's appropriate because now's not the time for it. Because the trial court didn't have the benefit of the understanding or the agreement of the parties at the time says that it was act the
but
agreement
you would
was
agree
made.
That if it had been disclosed at sidebar, as you suggested, or in chambers, that's where we would be. We would be having an inquiry into whether or not your client had upheld his end of the bargain.
The trial court would, and right. Perhaps this court would on review. But as the court emphasized in why this is a problem in Cole, quote, this will greatly reduce the potential for after-the-fact confusion. More importantly, by spending the time necessary to reduce an agreement to writing, the parties can obviate the necessity for holding a hearing to determine whether an agreement exists in its terms, thereby saving several days of a judge's and the party's time. Well, if the answer is that, well, we don't have to obey Rule 11 so long as we have a hearing that says afterwards, what's the point of having this provision of Rule 11? It's sort of like, well, it's mandatory unless the parties don't follow it. Or, you know, I don't mean to be flip, but it's almost like the rule is mandatory. But, if we permit after the facts as hearings to address what should have been addressed on the front end, it's like the court, the co-revisors almost should have an advisory note at the end of the rule to the effect that this really isn't literal.
It's not like we don't understand the difficulty of this kind of side agreement. Probably neither the prosecutor at the time nor defense counsel at the time has a firm view of what it is exactly the police want the defendant to do that they would then later report to the Attorney General was indeed cooperation as they saw it. So it's hard to say you will follow points 1 through 9, bullet 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, and check them off as he does them, and then he's fulfilled the side agreement, and therefore they don't ask that he be declared a habitual offender. That's very difficult to do when you're putting a plea together. I don't believe we don't understand that. We do. But where do we go? What do we do to prevent this kind of situation as a result? We need some help with that. Cole says what it says, and it's talking about the ideal, when everybody has time to sit down, reach a firm understanding of what the side agreement is, put it in detail, and it's easy to follow whether someone solved it or not. But this isn't the case, and I suspect there's more than a few of these kind of agreements out there. Defense wants to enter into them. Prosecution wants the police to have an additional tool in drug investigation, so they're willing to go so far. But how do you nail it down in a way that we can practically solve the kind of problem that you present us today?
How it's nailed down is the rule is the rule. There's no dispute about its terms or its requirements. It's required, says, to be followed. There's conceivable prejudice under
these. In this case, as I understand it, the rule wasn't followed with the concurrence of your colleague. Is that correct?
So, that's correct.
So you've got a client who, with the advice of counsel, knowingly didn't follow the rule, and now, later, would like the rule strictly enforced. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think the client or the defendant himself is blameworthy under these circumstances because, really, in a sense here, we're talking about what is the agreement or what is an agreement. Like I said, it's not something concrete that you can usually pick up unless it's on a piece of paper. And, you know, perhaps the finest legal minds in Delaware are gathered here this morning with the exception of Mr. Williams and myself, or perhaps just myself, to try to resolve this question.
Well, most of our law clerks are here, but not all of them. Most of our law clerks are here, but not all of them.
But that you see an inconsistency in arguing that the rule wasn't followed and therefore he should get to withdraw his plea, rather than saying the rule wasn't followed and there was a bigger agreement. Now we should have a hearing that looks into the bigger agreement.
Well, then, what the court said in Cole essentially says really has no teeth. It means that, well, you know, if you didn't follow, says the rule, which is there because it's necessary to carry out certain objectives, for instance, to avoid the problem of judges having to reconstruct facts months or years afterwards.
Well, we must be talking about a different Cole case. I'll reread it. The Cole case that I thought you were talking about had different implications. It was the one that we remanded because the person was in the middle of trial and during the course of the trial entered into a negotiation about whether the death penalty would be drawn at a subsequent time. It had nothing to do with him pleading guilty to anything. It simply had to do with whether he was going to give testimony. Now, admittedly, it's still an agreement with the state, and it still should have been written down. But it isn't the type that you would have put on the record under Rule 11.
I could be mistaken, but I thought it was, Your Honor. In fact, I was surprised that the parties didn't mention this Rule 11 in Cole.
Well, even if the side agreement here, such as it was, had been put on the record, intuitively, it seems to me, there's going to be a dispute later on about what cooperation meant, what activity by the defendant, what request made by the police of the defendant, what that all entailed, and whether the defendant who says, I did cooperate, or the police say, no, he didn't to the degree we wanted him to, who would have known at the time that this side agreement, the degree to which the police wanted him to cooperate? I suspect nobody knows.
Well, that's present in every, says, legal dispute. And I know the court has to, says, unravel, or trial judges unravel situations where there are 60 and 75-page contracts in business disputes, yeah. Which, well, and they're nonetheless.
On the other hand, if cooperation could have been defined, you have to make 3 undercover drug buys on our behalf while we watch you, and we'll mark the money and all the rest of that. 3 will do it between X date and Y date. Then you've got an easy agreement to tell whether someone cooperated or not.
Sure.
But we just don't know what the situation is.
Sure. But if in this situation the party said, well, we agree to this, and then the defendant says, either off the record in a in-camera hearing, or let's say the court, I can't do that, and the court says, the parties, you are not in agreement. I want you to leave the courtroom now. I want you to be back at 4 o'clock and submit to me a memorandum of agreement. And then the court reviews it and determines whether that's sufficient to comply with Rule 11. The court doesn't have to accept the plea. But the court can require the parties to follow, says the rule. At least it provides a framework. It's like a 75-page contract that a court has to resolve in a business dispute when there's a dispute between the parties. It may not resolve it, but it's a good start.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. You have less than a minute left in rebuttal.
I'd like to reserve if the court permits, but right. I appreciate the court's
thank you very
questions.
Much. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. In answer to one question that the court raised about the timing in Cole, the Cole decision was issued by this court on October 19, 2005. The plea in this case was entered September 15, 2005, so the plea was entered approximately a month before Cole came down.
That's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Cole was not a plea case, was it? It was just an agreement case.
Yes, that's right. And there is language in there that I think is appropriate, certainly, that agreements between counsel need to be in writing. The terms need to be spelled out. And some of the more important language in Cole as well is that there's an obligation of good faith dealing when the state's dealing with criminal defendants and their counsel in all these matters. I think the court certainly understands and appreciates the difficulty that ensues here. What happened was Mr. Scarborough wanted to be released on an unsecured bond. He had previously been picked up on a capias and I think had a $10,000 bond at the time pending his sentencing after he entered his guilty plea. In order to do that, his request, Mr. Scarborough's request, to be released on unsecured bond was that he wished to work with the drug investigation authorities and perhaps facilitating other drug investigations at the time, not his case, but presumably some other target defendant. That was the gist of everything.
But don't you find it a little troubling, for want of a better term, that everyone let him say there's no other agreement when, in fact, there was another agreement?
Oh, absolutely. And I've had a discussion the last couple of days with a prosecutor in saying that, look, the cleanest way to do these things is to have everything on the record. Admittedly, it's difficult when you're in court taking pleas and numerous other criminal defendants are present, some of whom already know the accused, to do it. But, you know, if you have to do it in chambers or somehow in camera, it's better to spell it out.
Mr. Williams, yes. If there was a side agreement, as the state appears to concede, which was not incorporated, it was not placed of record in the formal plea agreement proceeding, then the state's position, I would take it, would have to be that the side agreement was not observed by Mr. Scarborough. Is that right? Is that your case?
Well, I think the agreement was the plea itself. And the only real question was whether or not, because the one thing the plea didn't address was what recommendation, if any, the state was going to make at sentencing. That was just an open fact.
I'm sorry.
Fact.
There was a side agreement. And you're saying it was incorporated, made part of the formal plea agreement?
Oh, no, no, I don't. No, what the plea agreement says is that Mr. Scarborough is going to plead guilty to 3 of his 9 charges. The other 6 will be nulliprost. He's to do a couple of other things. He's to testify truthfully in a robbery investigation. That was his resisting arrest charge against 2 co-defendants, and he's to submit to drug evaluation and follow any recommendations. That's everything that's in there. There's no agreement by the state at that point as to what the sentence recommendation, if any, by the state will be. The plea agreement specifically spells out that he is habitual criminal eligible.
He was on notice pursuant to the written agreement that he was eligible, but what wasn't disclosed is he was also told, if you cooperate, do whatever you're supposed to do pursuant to the undisclosed side agreement successfully, then the state is not going to ask for you to be sentenced as a habitual offender. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if it went that far, but I think it was certainly that the state was going to strongly consider whatever cooperation you furnish to law enforcement authorities, and that will affect the decision as to whether or not.
This is, as they say, deja vu all over again with Cole.
Yes,
going to
go
to the fives, and the fives are going to decide whether you're going to get the death penalty or whether the state's going to seek the death penalty or not. But I, the prosecutor, will make no recommendation one way or another, and then the record doesn't show what or anything was considered by the fives. And the issue of good faith consideration of the state's consideration for the bargain becomes an issue. So what are you telling us, that this is an agreement without consideration, this side agreement? And what role does it play in the trial judge being able to say, here, I've got the written agreement, and I've got your statements before me under oath. As far as I'm concerned, that's it. That's all I need to know. You're done.
Well, that's certainly how the trial judge ruled in this case. I mean, he said, and he pointed out to Mr. Scarborough, he says, but, you know, what you're saying is directly contradicted by your own statement under oath.
And that's the problem, because the prosecutor and the defense attorney all knew that when the representation was made to the court.
Well, I think that's true, and probably the difficulty, and there's also a difficulty in how you contractually structure all these things as to, you know, what it is that's expected of Mr. Scarborough that is then going to trigger some sort of affirmative recommendation by the state or the state refraining from seeking a habitual criminal status. Mr. Scarborough's complaint was that he never would have entered into this plea if he thought he was going to be sentenced as a habitual criminal. Now, that's contradicted by both the prosecutor and defense counsel. Defense counsel says, no, he was told that. That's the reason I wrote that on the plea agreement, and he and I simply have a different recollection about, you know, what was or wasn't disclosed. So if there was any confusion on the part of the defendant, it's certainly not corroborated by either counsel.
And we understand from the record that his original attorney was withdrew and he got substitute counsel, and that was fairly actively pursued in the record. But the real question is, if everybody in the room, the prosecutor and everybody in the room except the judge, knows that there's a separate agreement, it seems a little awkward to have a disposition based upon the fact that you told me that was the agreement, when in fact Scarborough is the only one being penalized by what appears, to use Mr. O'Donnell's suggestion, that this is the custom or practice or something like that. Somehow we have to get this all sorted out, don't we?
Yes, and I think Mr. O'Donnell's correct. I think that certainly was the practice, that that's how they did it. The counsel for both sides would simply approach the bench, and there would be a sidebar. It usually wasn't very detailed, and that's how these things were done, if they were done at all. But the difficulty, I guess, here, and perhaps the easiest way to do this, if the decision, the basis for the decision, the court below, is simply not accurate, given all the additional facts that trial judge was not privy to, is to remand it back to the trial court, allow them to conduct an evidentiary hearing. The real difficulty, I think, here from Mr. Scarborough's point of view is, well, okay, even if you had this other agreement, you never did anything. You made one phone call to the police, but you never followed up. You never did any assistance. So why are you complaining now that the state filed a habitual criminal motion? You were told that in the written plea agreement. Your own attorney says you were told that. The trial judge at the plea colloquy told Mr. Scarborough that, and he acknowledged it on the record. So it's like you can't be claiming you had absolutely no knowledge.
The suggestion of a remand may be helpful because, as the Chief Justice said, we can develop the parameters at a hearing. Because in this case, at least in the briefing without any record support, there was a suggestion that Mr. Scarborough was asked to do things that were dangerous. And he didn't think that was part of the agreement, and that he did, according to the representations in the brief, what he was supposed to do, but drew the line at these requests that he thought were life-threatening.
The more fundamentally troubling to me is, what was his understanding of what he was to do at the time he entered into the side agreement, and what was the state's expectation of what he would do at the time of the side agreement? I have this fitful concern that all that was asked was, I agree to cooperate with the police, and all the state asked was for him to cooperate with the police, and it's illusory as to what the terms of that cooperation would be. So if it were remanded, what would the trial judge have to work with? He has nothing in writing to say what cooperation meant. Think of it as a defined term in a contract. What does cooperation mean? And then what are the steps that had to be taken in order to fulfill that contract? The overlay that's troubling is the suggestion in Cole that there's a standard of good faith that applies, and that the prosecution has the utmost good faith to exercise because the prosecution is in control from beginning to end in these kinds of side agreements. What I'd like to see happen as a result of this is get some concrete parameters to the whole process, not just in this case, but generally, so we don't see this again. And your suggestions in that respect, to the extent they relate to any disposition of this case, would be really helpful.
Well, I think that's certainly the thing to do, and it's certainly the next logical step from Cole. I mean, Cole's been out there for over a year now. People should certainly be aware of it. And I think the thing to do to give assistance to everybody, the defense attorneys, the prosecutors, the trial judges who have to deal with these things on a day-to-day basis, and they are unwieldy and they're not easy to handle, is to spell this out in as much detail as possible. And, you know, if it needs to be done in camera, Cole says these things need to be in writing. You know, the counsel need to draft something. And, yeah, you know, if we have to teach them how to draft contracts, that's what we have to teach
them.
And
I can't stress enough, if you have to go back to your office and explain some opinion that comes from us at some point, that we do not miss the point that these things happen often at the last minute in plea negotiations, and it's very difficult to nail it all down in the kind of detail that would be helpful later on. And we know that both sides want to get it done. They want the plea. And sometimes putting less meat on the bones of the agreement will get the plea than putting more. We're very conscious of that. So I at least would be reluctant to try to present you with some, either side, with some bright line rules that ought to apply. That's why in Cole we didn't go any further than saying whatever it is, it would be an awfully good idea to put it in writing at the time it occurs, because that gives us all something to work with from that time on. But we haven't lost sight of the difficulty in the real world of getting this done within a short period of time, with the angst and the apprehension and the tension of getting a plea in place on a given day.
I think that's certainly apropos here, where somebody's facing a potential life sentence. I mean, let's get it done. I want this done.
By the same token, whatever time and energy is saved by imprecision on the front end gets multiplied many-fold on the back end, as this case and the Cole case evidence.
Oh, absolutely, and that's why I pull what little hair I have left out when I get these things.
Well, let's not go there.
I'm sorry.
That works on both sides.
That it is difficult. I mean, these are appeals. We're limited to the record, and sometimes the record's just simply inadequate. I mean, I know from my own experience from both sides how these things typically play out, and I can kind of read into what probably happened between the lines, but at the same time, that doesn't necessarily pin it down any more concretely. A procedure that everyone can follow, the courts, the attorneys, the accused will know exactly what to do, is certainly going to be preferable, and it'll avoid these kind of situations. I mean, we're here, the trial judge has made a ruling on one basis, but the state doesn't dispute that what he asked for was to be released so that he could work with police. That's absolutely true, and the state was certainly going to consider whatever he did in deciding what recommendation, if any, to make at sentencing. That's all true, and that needs to be rolled into the process so that we don't have situations like this. Here, it's my understanding from talking with the trial prosecutor that there were discussions back and forth, even after the entry of the plea, with defense counsel and the prosecutor. There are some emails. Those could all be presented to the trial judge, and then the trial judge can systematically review it and make a more comprehensive ruling. It would certainly be more appropriate for this court's review. That's why I think perhaps the easiest solution is to remand it to get the further facts clarified about this. The state's position is that he didn't perform the cooperation with the police under any reasonable interpretation, that simply making one phone call is not what is envisioned by cooperating with law enforcement authorities, and that he really doesn't have a legal basis to complain at this instance. But that's really for the trial judge to decide, and the trial judge needs to be apprised of all the facts, and I think the remand may be the easiest and most economical and certainly the clearest way to do that. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those. Thank you.
There are 2 points I'd like to make, Your Honor. One, with respect to Justice Holland's inquiries and questioning me about the Cole case. With all due respect, Justice Holland, I've just checked the Cole case, and I submit that we are both correct. The court is correct that the specific question in Cole concerning the suppression of a statement concerning the 23rd Street murders. However, there was a plea to the Lancaster Avenue, it says murders, that afternoon after the statement was given. Actually, though the principles that I've discussed this morning would be applicable if there were a motion to withdraw that plea concerning the 1348 Lancaster Avenue murders, but there wasn't. But nonetheless, the court discussed at length all of the principles in Cole. In fact, it discussed immediately after reciting the facts, plea agreements, and why they should be enforceable, et cetera, and why they must be in writing. So I was looking at the principle, but I was incorrect on the specific procedural facts.
Before you, I know yes, you have sir. Another point, but your time's out. But before you sit down, what's your perspective on Mr. Williams' recommendation of a remand?
A remand? I don't mean to be flip, but what a remand says to parties and practitioners is we don't have to worry about Rule 11 because it can always be sorted out later. And if there's going to be remands, where do you draw the line? There's on remands. Do you remand it always? Well, then why have Rule 11 if you remand it always to have all these extrapolated proceedings on the back end? And as Cole points out, the state is always in a superior position under these circumstances, and it's unfair to defendants if Rule 11 is not followed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.